All right. So first of all, welcome and thank you for coming. I see some new faces. And before we start, you just want to bring your mind to this place. There's so much happening in our life all day long, and yesterday and today and tomorrow, things will go on. But for this next 2 hours, you are here, and so you want to bring your mind here and get a lot of the chatter out of it. So let's just do a little 7-point meditation. And all that 7 points stands for is the posture of the body. And so we sit back straight, keep your back not too tight, just like a stacked coin, straight. The legs, for those that are seated, can be in a cross position, call it vajra position, either full or half. But most of us are sitting on a chair, so just make sure your feet are flat on the floor. Your arms are loose here, but then the right one goes on top of the left, and your thumbs are touching each other. And just right about slightly below your navel, resting on your lap. Your head is slightly tilted. Your jaw and mouth are relaxed. The teeth are just slightly apart, and your tongue is on the palate behind the top of the teeth. And your eyes can be shut, or they can be slightly open. Okay? And what we want to do is first just find out there's no tension in the body, be relaxed, be comfortable, and then scan your body, release any tension you may have or you're holding. And then slowly when you're taking a breath, just focus on the breath going in and breath coming out. Either you can focus on your nostrils where the air is entering, or you can concentrate on your abdomen when it goes out and in. Just one place, just relax. And when you do that, your mind may scatter and start thinking of maybe for the first second or so, it feels good, and then it starts to tell you a story. You might see colors. You may have thoughts. Observe them. Tell them they are just thoughts, and just put them aside and bring your concentration back to the breath. Let's do that for a few minutes. Let your mind be flexible. Don't get tight. If those lot of thoughts come in, just again observe them, acknowledge them, let them go. Just like the flowing water. You see the leaves going by, you see the leaf, but then it goes away. Or just like a beautiful sky, just a cloud, it will go away. Same way. I'll lead you right into motivation. So the wind of the spring and the clouds are moving, but the space stands still. I would like us to meditate right now. We will do a little bit of breathing practice, and then we will just relax. Let your relaxed mind be like space that is standing still. And again, the thoughts that arise in it are just little energetic activity of the spring outside. The reason for this is to get a perspective of the thoughts as thoughts arise within your mind, including the thought of I. that is but one of the energetic goings-on in apparently the space-like changeless essence. So the breathing exercise or practice that we will do today is the 9-round breathing practice. So if you can just bring your attention to me for a moment. So we all together, you're going to take your ring finger, okay? And then you're going to put your ring finger on the left nostril. You're going to inhale, right? So just watch me. You're going to go very nice and slowly right to your abdomen, not uncomfortable, not so tight and holding it on, and then just relax and just close your right nostril and exhale. So that's using the left hand. You do that 3 times, okay? Then you take your right hand, and you're going to start with the right side. You do that 3 times. And the 3rd time, you're going to take it in both nostrils and exhale from both nostrils. At least start with that, and then I'll take you to the next step. Okay? So just together, when at your pace, just do it 3 times. And then... but nice and easy. You don't have to analyze anything, just to be relaxed and be aware. This is great to take a lot of some of the obscurations of the day out. It clarifies your mind, and you want to be thinking about maybe at the last couple of breaths that you're practicing, all the two classes that we've gone through. Maybe you want to just keep in mind of what is it that you've learned, what is it that you're here to learn, and imagine how wonderful it would be once you know this wisdom of emptiness to lead all living beings from their misery into happiness by means of that attainment. And why do we even say those things? We've talked about bodhicitta. We've talked about bodhisattvas. How important it is. We gave you a little piece last class about bodhicitta. And if everything is interdependent, you are no different than I am. We are all interconnected. And when you're thinking outward of yourself, you're not thinking about I. Very important. Okay, thank you. So before we go into the summary of the last 2 classes, I see a lot of new faces, so I may need to slow down just a little bit, so have a little patience, because I just don't want to start talking about, let's look for that I, when a person sitting here may not know what we are talking about, right? So I'm going to slow down a little bit for them, and then we will get into today's class, okay? So, some history behind the course. Let's just talk about the class 1. This is, by the way, Discovering Buddhism Module 12. It is a greater scope, if you understand the 3 scopes of Buddhism. Okay? It's like going through 1st to 4th or 5th grade, then going from 5th to 7th grade, and then from 8th to 11th grade. It is that way. There's a lot of build-up to reach to understand, and they think that at this point you're ready to understand some of these concepts. Okay? And if you even are a little familiar with Lam Rim, the stages of the path, then you know how it actually shows. They show you everything you need to do to reach the ultimate goal, right? To become a Buddha. Okay? So when we first started the class, what did we do? We give credits to the teacher. That's part of the, if you look at Lam Rim, The teacher has to be an appropriate teacher. The student has to be an appropriate, in a, not only appropriate, but in a mindset to learn. So we went through a history. Not only that, it was an affirmation and a confirmation that it's not a made-up thing. Hemant didn't sit here and just say, you know what, today is my class, let me make some steps, let me Google a few things. Absolutely not. Matter of fact, we discourage. We think you need to look at who wrote it, follow the lineage teaching that comes all the way from Buddha, who the masters that have debated over years and have said, this is the way it is. So it's important to know that lineage a little bit. And it also gives you a little bit of conviction inside you that this is just not some author that wrote a book and we're just deciphering it. No, this has been going on for that 2,500 years. Okay? So what did we do? I introduced you, we first started by saying we're not going to have jargon, and I immediately introduced you with some names of people that sounds like a jargon. So it's important because these names, as you read your PDFs or as you are reading about it, you will hear them, there are those names again and again. And for right now, all you need to recognize, these names are important. But the name Chandrakirti. And you heard now that out of all the schools, the one that we follow, which we will talk about in a second, Chandrakirti is the one that really came up with that conviction that this is what emptiness is all about. We talk about Shanti Deva all the time. There are some other names like Arya Deva, Nagarjuna, and we will introduce today Dharmakirti. But just know that these were masters, philosophers, some of them were logicians, and they spent years and years and years reading and understanding and meditating on Buddha's teachings. That's what we need to know. Okay? We also talked about the teachings came straight from Shakyamuni Buddha, and then we went into how he wrote 84,000 teachings that came out of his discourses. They were divided into three bundles, and the bundles were divided into the bundle of discipline, the bundle of sutras or discourses, and a bundle of knowledge. Okay? So when we use the word sutra, you know it's a discourse. Okay? We even talked a little bit about two vehicles, the Mahayana and the individual vehicle. Not to pay too much attention, you need both to become Buddha. Okay? It's like not going to 7th and 8th grade and wanting to graduate from master's degree. Can't do that. So it's not a low or high doesn't mean good and bad. It just means type of thinking. We are Mahayana practitioners. Our main way of thinking is to benefit all sentient beings. That's our key thing. And the importance of it is given through bodhicitta and becoming a bodhisattva. Okay? Then what we talked about was importance of a heart sutra. Right? We talked about heart sutra. And what did we talk about heart sutra? It was written by 25,000 verses. It was broken down into 8,000 verses. But how lucky we are that we got the juice of it in the Heart Sutra. When you read the sutra, you hear these big Sanskrit names, Prajna Paramita, Hridaya, and all this. Don't get boggled by all that. All that means is Prajna meaning wisdom, Paramita meaning perfection, Hridaya meaning heart. So when you say wisdom of perfection, of the Heart Sutra, same thing. Okay? We did establish a little bit of base before going into emptiness, thinking about the two truths, the relative truth and the ultimate truth. You know, we started with the fact that when you get into deep into this, which we will today in some analysis, the mind will go towards emptiness almost nihilistic, like if nothing exists, then what is all this? Your mind will go there. And sometimes you got to bring it back. Remember, we are following the middle way. Madhyamika means the middle way. And that means you don't want to be nihilistic, nor you want to challenge the fact if anybody says they exist intrinsically or their ultimate truth is in there. We need to know what that is. Okay? So just kind of keep that in mind. And so we established those two truths to just give you a little background on how it is intertwined between our daily life. We go to work, we see each other. We see each other often. The cushions are there. So we can't deny that cushion. What we are really trying to understand is that cushion existing in its own self? So we are learning about how things exist. It's not denying the fact that it exists right now. is how it exists. That's what we are trying to decipher. So keep that partition in your mind, because when you get in the subject matter, it starts to take you to one thing. If this is empty, that is empty, this is empty, then what does exist? And we will talk about that a little bit more today, so you can kind of put a little perspective on it. Okay? So far, so good? I know there's two new people in there. I just want to make sure that I'm giving some background on this class, okay? We also talked about, we use these words all the time, method and wisdom. Okay? What does that mean? And we said those are the two wings. You need both wings to fly. But somebody had to sit down and think, what is method? What is wisdom? So you already know we have a logical side and a practice side, how we behave, what we do. So when you think about becoming a bodhisattva, developing bodhicitta, and your practices to become that, that's your practice side, the method side, how you do it. And the logical side is, what is it? And that's what we're studying, emptiness. Okay? The emptiness, the English word emptiness, automatically takes you to something that is either it's full or it's empty. So our mind fights that word. There are many ways to identify the word emptiness. You can say selflessness, identitylessness, shunyata, emptiness, ultimate truth, right? These are all synonymous. Okay?
Yeah. It also sounds negative.
Right. Yeah, when you say something like, oh, it's empty, and then you say, what do you mean it's empty? Right? It means nothing. And that's not what it's saying. So keep that in mind, that when we are talking about this, these questions will come up, but have a flexible mind to understand where the masters are leading us, or where Buddha is leading us. The second thing I want to talk about is that we got into a little bit of lineage, and we talked about the wonderful legends of Nagarjuna. We also talked about the four schools, how they came about, and how many thousands and thousands of philosophers and masters they debated. Specifically, this one area called Abhidharma is a text called Abhidharma, and it talks about logic. Where do things come from? And they actually debated at one point, if you chop everything down to the atoms, then atoms must be the real thing. That's how it all started. Then they took it next step. But if my mind doesn't see that atom, does that atom exist? That kind of thinking went on. And ultimately, Nagarjuna came up with the middle way of looking at how things are. Okay? And Chandrakirti, his student, also started to pull real piece out of it, and that's what we study. And it's Lama Tsongkhapa, Lama Tisha. If you look at all the lineages, it's again and again confirmed that this is the way we need to see things.
With metaphysics even at that time.
Right. So that's one thing. Then we talked about the traditional thinking of, we talk about sin and merits. Okay? We use those words and just look at it for what they are, that you can say non-virtuous actions and virtuous actions. All merits are like, think about how much gas do you, bank balance do you want to have? These merits are virtuous actions that build you. They create the causes and conditions for your next life to be in a better place. But what happens if you're just focusing on your own self and building merits? When they're used up, what happens? You're back to starting again. So it's like a bank balance. When you have a bank balance, you have money, you are wonderful, you're altruistic, you want to be helpful, you can talk and you feel good, you can even donate blood, whatever you want to do. But then when you are empty and there's nobody, friends go away, you feel lousy, you get depressed. Same way in merits, life after life, you want to really you want to be virtuous, but at the same time, you want to understand what is the truth. Where do I need to go? What is my journey? Right? And that's what this is all about. And we are talking about this wisdom. We are talking about how things exist. If I only knew how things exist, then I know how to react to it. Then I know what to do. And what not to do. Okay? And then we ended the first class by just introducing the concept of ignorance. What is ignorance? We say that it is because of ignorance we don't know what the truth is. Okay, that's what we talked about a little bit. So I just introduced not knowing what ultimate reality is, is actually the ignorance that doesn't allow you to see the truth. Okay? And we will talk about that a little more today, how it affects you. We went through a couple other things. We went through, talked about wisdom and emptiness. We even introduced very briefly the five paths of bodhisattvas. We talked about the 10 stages of bodhisattvas. Talked a little bit about 12 links. So for those people that are new, Buddhism is very precise. They have everything, a two of this and a three of that. And when you just think you got it, there are six of these. Okay? And the reason it is, they are very logical. If you can interpret a pinch as a pain, they will tell you three different pains. Even a change, when a change takes place, it's painful. When somebody hurts you, it's painful. So they will say there are three kinds of pains. So they are very precise, and it's a good thing. It allows you to really understand it. Okay? So take it that way. So all it is five paths is when you are on a journey to become a Buddha or a realized being, there are certain paths you take. And I'll just rattle them off, not to worry about them. You are in a path of accumulation, a path of preparation, a path of seeing. Then you get into the meditation stage. And once you are in there 100%, no more learning, you are enlightened. That's the path they take. And there are stages in between. Okay? And there are 12 links to this cyclic existence. What do we mean by cyclic existence? This birth and death cycle. We are born, then life starts, we age, and then we die. And so, how does that happen? And it starts with the word ignorance. After ignorance, because of ignorance, you do certain activities. As soon as you do activities, now the awareness grows around it, right? And then we have a name and a form to everything. And then that becomes real for you, right? All of a sudden your six senses come in and want to touch it, feel it. I like it, I don't like it. You start that. Then you start to crave for things. Then you grasp for those things. You develop feelings for them, right? This is how this whole cycle begins. And then what happens? You crave for existence the way you do. And then when the time of death comes, your thought is on to, I want to be who I was. Where am I going to go? I don't know where I'm going. So I like what I am, and I am here, and so that becomes your next seed that starts. But if you look at it, Buddha says that life cycle is dukkha. That means the suffering. There are little pleasures too in there, but typically pleasures don't last. And when you're dying or sick or something, there's a problem in life, and this birth and death. Death is not very pleasurable for a lot of people, right? So this is a cycle, and if you want to get out of it, I have the way. So anyways, so in class 2, we went into reciting the Heart Sutra. Again, we discussed Heart Sutra in the class 1, but we brought it down, and we talked about Heart Sutra, and then we realized this was a conversation. So Buddha is sitting in a very nice location, place called Rajagira, Vulture Mountain. So they say the place was right, the time was right, all these bodhisattvas ascended there, and while he was in perfect concentration, due to that, there is a conversation between these two names, Shariputra asking question to a bodhisattva named Avalokiteshvara. Don't worry about the name, it is a conversation in presence of Buddha through Buddha's perception. And it talks about how should one understand what is the truth, in general, paraphrasing it. And it goes very quickly, and it says, the son of the lineage or the daughter of the lineage who wishes to practice this activity of profound perfection of wisdom should look upon like this correctly. Those five aggregates also are inherently empty of existence. Those five aggregates are form, feelings, discrimination or perception, right? Mental formations, compositional factors they call it, and consciousness. It does not exist on its own. Okay? And then it goes into further. And because of that, if it doesn't exist, then does an eye exist and does a tongue exist? So the people who still don't understand the concept here, if you just very cleanly look at it, that eye, tongue is a label that we put on a particular tissue that is supported by so many other things, blood cells and tissues, water, heat, so many things, everything is interdependent. So by itself, it does not exist. So that's how they mean. So things inherently in nature are like that. That's what they're trying to say. And we'll go into that. And then they made that whole Heart Sutra into a concise way of looking at it, and they used the mantra, Tayatha Gate Gate Paragate Parsamagate Bodhisoha. Gone, gone, gone beyond, gone way far beyond, be it. Okay? And if you think about it, are three distinct paths, the low, the middle, and high. You start here, you start to understand, you practice, and you go beyond. You can also say going to the other side. Paragate also means going to the other side. But in these terms, it is our mental state that is reaching a certain level. How wonderful. If you can just say those words in your mind and know the meaning behind it, then it means a lot. It's a whole sutra put together in those words. Okay? So in the end, Buddha says, well said, so it's a confirmation, and that's how the Heart Sutra ends. So then we talked about we should generate some level of what they call six perfections. We talked about that when you're sitting here and you're listening, develop a mind of a generosity mind, be open to it, have some ethics, morality, have some patience while listening, have some enthusiasm or joyful effort to come here and learn, and then what you're developing is the meditation or concentration, and in the end, you're going to develop wisdom. All bodhisattvas, all people on the path, practice this all the time. Make sense? It's just a beautiful way of looking at things. If you have these six perfections, you are on your way. All the time. Okay? And you have to contemplate those things. I mean, this is not the class to talk about what is generosity and what is patience and all that, but just remember those six perfections. And we have to be flexible to understand these things. Allow your mind to understand, learn, listen, contemplate, and meditate. If you don't listen, then you don't have the knowledge. And if you don't have the knowledge, you cannot contemplate. And then what are you going to meditate on? So it's important to keep your mind open and understand. Questions will come. Obviously, this subject is a little hard to first get in the mind. So there will be questions. But think about it. Listen to the entire thing. Write it down. And we'll be more than happy to discuss it. And if I don't know, we are just so lucky to have Geshe-la here. And we can certainly take advice. Right? So we can then discuss it honestly. Okay, so we also touched a little bit about ignorance, and we talked a little bit about there are two types of practitioners, a faithful practitioner and analytical practitioner. We all have both of them. But a faithful practitioner is the one that if somebody, a teacher says, this is the way it is, they accept it. There's no question in their mind. But a lot of us in the Western world are analytical. Right? We don't want to know, what are you talking about? What does that mean? Does this path even exist? What does it mean to be Buddha? Who is Buddha? So we have these questions. And what it's saying here is you need to have, in order for ignorance to go away, you need to develop this wisdom. It's okay. And once you receive this knowledge and you develop conviction, when you have conviction, now you can read it with a lot more enthusiasm and understand it. Right? Otherwise, it just becomes technical jargon. Okay, here's one kind of group of people, they think this way, and this is what they say all the time. It's not going to go in your system that way. You will have some knowledge. Okay. And then there are some people who think, this is hopeless. Like, I'll go through some technical pieces today, and I know some of you will get it, and some of you will say, wait, what was that? You know, that will happen, and it's okay. But don't ever think it is hopeless. Okay? Or that I can't understand it. I'm just so not there. That is a delusion. You can do it. It just takes time for some people, and some people will get some concepts quickly. Right? Okay, so let's talk about ignorance before we really get into the subject today. Okay? So, according to the writings I've been reading from Nagarjuna and some of the schools, here's what it says. Ignorance here is not a passive absence of knowledge. Think about that word. Ignorance here, what we are discussing is not a passive absence of knowledge. It's not like I didn't read the manual before putting my TV up. I'm just going to do it without reading the manual. Oh, I don't know what to do. Not that knowledge. It is an active misknowledge or misconception of reality. That's the knowledge we are talking about. What is the truth? What is the reality? Right? So an example of that is, remember we talked about last time, you have a $20 bill that you think you have. You go to buy something, it's $19.95. You take it out of your wallet, and it's a $10 bill. Right? So there's a misconception. It's an error in your judgment or thinking, and you thought you had a $20 bill, but it was $10 bill. Right? It's not saying you don't have other monies. It's just what you thought you had is not there. So that's how our mind does tricks sometimes. So ignorance plays a little game trick like that with us. Okay? So it's just a misconception, and you need to know that. It also leads to some misknowledge. So it's another term that we use. It's a mental event that wrongly engages an object. That's happened to us many times. We thought I had it, and when you look at it, like, oh gosh, I thought I had this one. What happened? Okay, so let's slow down there. It's a mental event that wrongly engages an object. Simple thing. And the main function of the mind is what? To know. Okay, to apprehend an object. But there are so many mental factors that even if you think you know sometimes, they can play a game on you and you can make a mistake. We've all been fooled before, right? So it can happen. Although, the good thing about our mind is that we are able to correct it. That is a big hope. Because our mind can cognize errors we've made. You can say, yeah, I took out the wrong bill yesterday. Today I'm going to check before I go shopping. It corrects itself, right, at some point. And so that good thing is, because we can do that, we can also remove ignorance. And if you remove ignorance, you have wisdom. Isn't that neat? We can be Buddhas. Okay, so sometimes why do we make these mistakes like this? Is a lot of emotion is played into it. We speculate, you could be upset, you could be thinking about a movie you want to go, you were in a rush. You have so many things going on in your mind that you don't even think about that you have a $20 bill or not. So you can see that on top, there are many layers working there. It is not a A, B, C, D clear, right? There are many factors working in our mind. So that's why we get some things completely wrong. And it may be due to our pride sometimes. We don't want to accept that we are ignorant. You know, we just feel a little tight about those things. Or we are sometimes lazy. We want to not able to plan it out or read a book and say, well, now I know it, let me do it correctly. It's just the nature of our mind right now. So let's introduce another name called Dharmakriti. He was a Buddhist philosopher and a logician. He studied epistemology. For those, that means is the investigation of what distinguishes justified belief from an opinion. A person who logically looks at everything. So I will take some time to read some of these things as we go along because I don't want to miss a critical word. Some of these sentences, just by missing the word, you can misapprehend what I'm trying to say. So I want to be a little careful. So he says, the innate function of the mind is to apprehend things as they are, as they appear. Okay, so for example, external conditions. You can look at a bush and say, oh, I think that's a person there. Maybe the light is low, and he appears like a guy, or a person, or a woman, and you will say, that's a person. So our mind will immediately see there's a person there. Okay? Internal conditions, if you're on medication, or if you have a jaundice or a yellow fever, you may see the world yellow. But it's not yellow. Right? There are many other conditions, internal and external, but our mind immediately apprehends what appears. That's the first thing it does. And also strong emotions play a role. When you're upset or something is not right, you don't see what is in front of you sometimes. You just create a story right in front of you. But all cause of distortion is superficial perception, and it can be corrected. That's a good thing. And according to Buddha, before Buddha, the point I want to make is a healthy skepticism is necessary. So when we talk to people, when we hear something, you know, don't be rough about, oh, I don't trust you. Not like that. But a little skepticism in your mind to see the facts, not get into the drama immediately, is important to know. And it means that the cause of cyclic existence is ignorance, which is the only misconception, is something that can be eliminated by anybody who has a mind. So the good thing is, all this misconception due to ignorance can be taken out if you have a mind. So it's a good thing. We all have the tools. So now we're going to go a little further. However, it says it's not easy. It's years and years and years of layers, right? It requires a lot of practice and thinking. Even Buddha didn't get enlightened like this. If you look at scheme of things according to books, it took him many lifetimes. So you have to have a long view. Don't expect to come in a class or to come to a couple of sessions and come to Sunday and think you're going to be enlightened right away. It's a great wish. And you could be. Depending on your path, depending on your understanding, you could be. But at least be honest about it and say, I'm going to take a long view, but I'm going to start something today. Or I am on the way, and I'm going to learn till I become. That's a great wish to have. And if it happens right away, it can happen in one lifetime. It has happened to many, many bodhisattvas, and we have stories about that. But just you need to know that if just within one class, if you think you can understand emptiness in every aspect of the way, you don't need to be here. Okay? So then ignorance causes what? So let's talk about ignorance that we need to remove, right? How does ignorance really delude your mind or dilute your mind? Ignorance is also a cause of destructive emotions. Think about anger. There is no wisdom in anger. It's a negative emotion and we need to get rid of it. So where does it come from? They use the word inappropriate attention. And what that means is to engage in a biased way or find fault in others, in them. And only the faults, nothing else. Like they're inherently faulty person. That's what happens. As soon as you get angry, your mind immediately goes to the faulty side and your biases are so foaming up here with anger, you don't even look at it. It's just some, whatever they say. Now, opposite would be what? If you like somebody, whatever they say, oh, that's so nice. It's so sweet. Right? It's amazing how our mind does that. And if you don't like it, or you hate that person, or you're angry, what happens? No matter what they do, it's not good. So that's how ignorance works. It already labels something, it gets biased, and that's how it perceives. So that's ignorance. That's destructive emotion. Okay? Clinging attachment. So what's the clinging attachment? It's a state of mind that arises from an inappropriate attention again. So it exaggerates the quality of an experience or an object. It's not only nice, it is terrific. It is absolutely beautiful. Right? Then what happens? I'll give an example of the new car that gets the first ding. That pleasure kind of goes away a little bit. You buy new clothes, you're excited. You go shopping, pink, yellow, mauve, this, that. You wear it for a couple of times. Now that kind of goes in the side, in the closet. I'm going to look for a new one. Nothing wrong with clothes, nothing wrong with cars. That's not what I'm getting at. It's how our mind goes through these little pleasures and it wants new ones because it doesn't want the harms. And then we find those temporary happiness, but none of them that lasts. So what happens? We cling on to those things because we want to feel good about it. Right? Even the teachers sometimes, you know, when you get too close to a spiritual teacher, even they'll push you away. Sometimes they will do that. They purposely do that to teach you that things are not always peachy and happy. Sometimes they give you a lesson like that. Your best friends, you love them all the time. Sometimes you can't stand them for a day. Like, get away. I need my own time. So these are little ways of our ignorance is working through attachment. And last class we also touched on a little bit about personal identity. And so the clinging attachment also depends on the self-identity. Negative states of mind are about the misapprehension of self-identity, okay? So what happens is we somehow think that the me really exists, okay? And because of that me that really exists, I told you during the death cycle or when you're coming close to the death, what happens? If you remember last class I said, if somebody were to ask you at that moment, who are you? What are you going to say? Who am I? Maybe a name comes in mind. I am Lee. You know, I'm Peter. I'm Jack. Something else. Maybe people who are a little advanced may say, oh, I'm a pretty decent person. Or if you're scared, who cares? I'm nobody. All these thoughts come to your mind. The mind is magnetized, is absorbed by something it can recognize. Right? When you are in a dire situation, and why do you get dire situation? Because you don't know where you are going. You don't know where that question mark is. Is that even another life? Maybe this is it. All these thoughts are in you, depending on your conviction. Right? So what happens? The mind clings on to that only thing it is familiar with. So if you have a bunch of non-virtues going around in your whole life, you've done nothing but do non-virtuous things, what do you think you're going to be comfortable with? That becomes your identity. If you're being around virtuous people and virtuous activity, your mind will gravitate automatically towards that because it doesn't know other. Right? And so that becomes the seed and causes and condition for your next birth. So look at how ignorance can wipe you out. And we are telling you to get into a virtuous mind. Don't cling on to things. Become a person of good human first. And then even if you are to come back by clinging a little bit to that, you may at least you'll be in a birth and death cycle again, but you may be in a better position. Or you can go into so many different realms. We don't want to talk about that. Okay. So Buddha recommends that we habituate ourselves with virtue and identify ourselves with being virtuous people. Matter of fact, it says this requires we generate such an image when we die that this is helped by outer circumstances we die in and inner disposition. Your surrounding that you've been dealing with and inner disposition of who you really are, that will go with you. And it says, just take a refuge. If but you also have to be very careful. You are under, depending on the circumstances of the death, how quickly it happens, or you're laying in the bed and it's prolonging, or whatever the case is. But your mind, even if it comes a little bit of sense in it, it will go and cling on to what it's familiar with. That's all I'm trying to say. So you should be familiar with the virtuous thoughts and don't cling on to these things and into the wrong anger and mine and possessiveness and all those things. All right? So you can see this is how we live in. Our world today manipulates, we manipulate, they manipulate, but we create these thoughts over thoughts from different tracks and the ignorance keeps building and building and building and now we see the world the way it is. Then we hop onto little happinesses and think that we are happy and sometimes it's not good. That's how we function. So, this leads me to our true subject today and why this was important. I purposely spent a little time on this because I can technically show you what exists and what not exists and how they said and not said. It needs to resonate with you. If it doesn't click with you, then it's not going to I'm still not following. It's going to happen. So if we keep on saying all the time is the way ignorance causes us not to see the real truth. It clouds our mind. So it's important to know what is ignorance. So now we have to think about how we can take it out slowly. Right? So we're going to go through a four-point analysis. And I'll be upfront with you. When I was going through this readings, it got so technical. I thought people all everybody will just get up and walk. It goes into, I can touch, my hand can touch, my finger can touch, I can see, I can sound, but who's sitting down? Is the hand sitting down? Is the nail sitting down? Is the hair sitting down? In the end, only my butt is sitting down, but does my butt really exist? It goes into that kind of logic. And it's like, what's the point? So I've tapered it down a little bit, and if you really want to dissect it, I'll be more than happy to sit with you, and if I can't, I can bring in the people who can.
Correct me if I'm wrong. Correct me if I'm wrong. Ignorance is that we are ignorant in the way we see things, which we all are going to be that way because at birth we are taught that everything is different. So what I used to think was, okay, it's me. I'm stupid. I did something that is ignorant. But if I'm correct in my thinking now, then it is really the way that we all have been brought up, that we all think of ourselves as this is Billy and this is a ball, and they are independent of one another.
Correct.
And so that when I went to that, then ignorance was easier for me to accept.
Correct. And you will see in this analysis precisely the point. The whole thing goes around in the circle, and it comes to this one conclusion, our mind does this. That's the whole idea of this four-point analysis. And to your point, it will talk about that.
And for me, emptiness never works mentally. I have to say emptiness of inherent existence, and then it clicks. So when I was in India last year, I said, because the teacher was throwing out emptiness, and I said, for some of us, you go there. But until you go to the English word, which is empty, and so it doesn't, now I see it a lot better, but I have to put all those words together for it to be concrete.
Absolutely. And that is why I prologued it by saying, take a long view. Some people it will click. Some people will not click till they filter out these things. All are right. It's not about they are advanced and you are not. Each one of us have so much accumulated, or the way we were brought up, or the traditionally what was important to you, what thoughts you've had, how you manufacture things. You can use the word ignorant or not knowing, right? Whatever it is. But as soon as you start to say, our mind's nature is to know. And our mind's nature is awareness. And as soon as you start to even get a glimpse of it, your behavior will change, number one. Then you will challenge yourself. Am I seeing this correctly? Am I reacting correctly? Those are all steps to filtering out that ignorance slowly. Instead of getting mad and saying something, maybe the first step is to just stop saying, maybe I don't say anything. Okay, let him say it. I'll go away. Maybe tomorrow we'll talk. That's the beginning. You're not going to jump straight to, this is empty, he doesn't exist, so who cares? It's not going to happen like that. Let's talk about those things, okay? Let's talk about step by step how we think and how we're going to get there. So if it gets a little technical, don't get too concerned. We can slow down. We can talk about it. But there is some logic to be applied. If you say things are not there, then you have to prove it is not there. And if you say things are there, then you have to prove it really exists. Show me it doesn't. Correct? We normally do that, don't we? Okay, so the way they use this, the four-point analysis, I'm going to say what they are, and I will remind you in between not to lose your mind on the overall bridge of what we are trying to build. What happens is when you get into this analysis, your mind gets into that picture, that vision, and saying, wait a minute, what does that mean? But remember the large picture. We are trying to remove the ignorance of not knowing how truly things exist. Or the I, or the self that we think is so concrete, how do I find that? Where is it? And it's easy to say, it doesn't exist. It's made up. But you feel it. I am here, you are there, I see you every day, you are my friend, you are my Facebook friends, I eat food, I'm hungry, I go to school, I go to job, then what is not I about that? That's our first thought. So now, when you get into the knowledge, the wisdom says, that's true. That's what we do. But if you really, really look for that I, it doesn't exist the way you think it exists. So it gets into that a little bit. So for that logic to take place, we have this four-point analysis, okay? So identify the person or I as it is misconceived by ignorance. Another way, identification of what is to be negated. These are the words that confuse people. What are you talking about? Okay? You want to find that and think it doesn't exist, or does it exist? So you have to negate it. If it truly is there, you have to say yes or no. So the second point says, deciding if that I or the person existed the way it is misconceived, then it must be findable in relationship to this body and mind complex. Because we can say, right, sometimes we say, yeah, my name is Jack. And I say, well, Jack is just a name. Yeah, but if you look at this mind-body complex, that's the label Jack. That's who I am. That's our mind, right? Right now, that makes even sense. So, in relationship to mind-body complex, or if that is not what I is, it must be independently of the complex. You have to put that in there because you're putting logic in it. If you say you're there, then it must be there or it's not. So they do this analysis to look at things logically. And then the last thing is proving that such an I or a person is not findable in relationship to body and body-mind complex. So the first two are the most important. Then they're just looking for the places. Is it part of you or not? Okay, and this is where the mind starts to go a little wacky, like say that again. So one more time. Four-point analysis, we are looking for that person or I. It says, let's identify that person or I as it is misconceived by ignorance. We've been saying, because of ignorance, we think who we are and I and all that. So let's look at it from that angle. And so that's what, and we want to negate that. Is it there or not? And then deciding if that person or I existed the way it is misconceived, then it must be findable in relationship to this body and mind, or it's independent, right? Just leave it at that, and we're going to look at that for a while, okay? So why do we do this? So its first point, it says, if you don't do this, the logical reason, otherwise all the logical reasons in the world will not affect the ignorance. If you don't have that conviction and really either find it or not find it, then you have a conviction. My I exists. Maybe for you, I doesn't exist. You have to be convinced. That's why they do this. It also gives a very good example is that it's like no matter how many powerful weapons you have, but if you don't know who the enemy is, what's the point of having the weapons? So that's how you're looking at it, okay? Don't get discouraged by these words. All it is a logic that's looking, if we say that this I does not exist, everything is interdependent, sounds all wonderful, even makes sense sometimes, but are you convinced and you want to prove that it truly does not exist? That's all it is about. Okay, so this is a logical way of going about it.
Can you repeat the third one?
Sure. I'll give you all four. We'll even do meditation on it. So the first one is identifying the person or an I as it is misconceived by ignorance. You will also see in your readings the same thing written, identification of what is to be refuted or negated. The second one is deciding that if the person existed the way it is misconceived, then it must be findable either in relationship to the mind-body complex or independently of this mind-body complex. Okay? So then the other way to say that is determining the mode of existence of such an I. How does it exist? And the third point, proving that such a person is not findable in relationship to the body-mind complex. And the fourth point is proving that such person is not findable independent of the body, mind complex. I can give you this in writing.
Okay.
It's no, don't worry about that.
Okay.
Yeah. So today's class is going to be somewhat this way. So we'll take slowly. I cut down a lot of it to make it and relate it to where we want to go with it. Okay? All right. So, first one, we talk about the identifying the person or I as it is misconceived by ignorance. Okay? So, what he's saying is, and I'm going to have to take my notes because we're going to walk through some logic here. But many terms are used to refer to this fabricated I or person, made up person right now. According to Dharmakriti, says, reality is a characteristic of only those things that are intrinsically able to produce effect. Let's think about that for a second. I'm going to slow down there. It's a simple concept. Reality is a characteristic of those things that are intrinsically able to produce effect. Right? Make sense? Just a simple statement. Okay? Then he used this definition because he observed people. And people are interested in what a thing can do for them. That's how people see things. What can it do for me? What can this do for me? And then what do? If it's beneficial or is it harmful? You do that, right? You think of everything you pick. It gives me pleasure or it doesn't. And then what we do, hop onto those little pleasures and we call that happiness. Fact, right? So then what we do is, when people examine whether those things work for you, and it's what it said it's going to do, then we call it real. That it is there. If you buy an iron and it irons, that's an iron. Right? Simple. But there's no assurance sometimes that what you claim it is will exactly do what it says it will do. Sometimes that happens too. So we'll keep that little open mind there. And so it says that the question of the ability, if it isn't then in the possession of the object, there is no guarantee that you will possess the ability. If you find out that the object does not have ability to do what it's saying, then that thing doesn't exist. That ability does not exist. It's just a logic way of saying it's right or wrong. Keep it at that. So we'll take an example. Now, a bunch of examples to get to the same point, but in a different way so people can apprehend different points. So let's take a look at a candle flame. According to Dharmakriti, he said, furthermore, a truly existent things are unique in terms of time and space. To be truly existent, it has to be truly existent in time and space. They exist in one place at one time, because when they function to produce an effect. Okay? In other words, what he's saying is, anything that exists on its own exists in one time, in one place, and they have an effect. So candle flame is a good way to look at it. Because these words play games with your mind. You don't follow it cleanly, but we will break it down, slow it down, so that you can understand it. So let's take a look at a candle flame that has been burning for 24 hours. It is not another candle flame, it's the same flame that's been burning. So from moment to moment, if you look at that candle flame, is the candle flame that you're looking at the moment the same as the candle flame before in the previous moment? And it's not. Our mind says it's the same candle burning. But if you look at from a moment to moment, is this candle flame the same as the previous candle flame? This candle flame is an effect of the previous candle flame. Logic so far? For at least most of us. Okay? So each thing, if you look at momentarily, it exists in its own, it creates an effect, and the thing continues. You can look at it differently. From a very mundane level, it can't be same. The wick is going down, it was yellow, now it's blue. It was tall, it's short. You can look at it from that angle too. But if you just look at it from a realistic point of view, how we look at things. So this is, and the reason we are doing this, guys, what does this have to do with emptiness? Right? We are creating a logical mind that says, okay, you've been saying I don't exist. So I technically need to find out where is that I and what is that I. They're taking you through examples of how mind perceives things and what mind does. So this is why, and they have different examples, and I got to keep an eye on my watch here so you don't get too much into this. So the flame of the previous moment ceased to exist when this moment of the flame arose. Okay, now comes a very interesting one. Let's take a cup. Okay, I'll use this as a cup right now. So this cup exists at one time and can be characterized as being able to hold water. I can drink it. So let's think about a general cup. When I say the word cup, what comes to your mind? Does this cup come to your mind? Or just the concept of the cup? What is a cup? You have already in your mind, a cup is something that holds something. Right? But does, so if I wanted to drink, which cup is going to make me drink? The conceptual cup or that object? So now let's be very pragmatic. Because if truly, and the reason we do that is a language. We create a language, a standard language, so people can communicate. Right? We need to use the word cup so we can kind of communicate, saying, can I get a cup of coffee? You kind of know what the person is saying. And all it is a created concept with a name and a thought. So when I say, when I objectively look at something and saying, this cup, if a picture goes to cup as a whole, and then this cup, two separate things, according to our mind. When we see the word cup, it is already ingrained in your mind that it's a cup. There are many cups in your kitchen cupboard. There are cups right now in China being made. There are many cups all over the world. Which cup? So when I'm drinking, will this object cup that we've titled cup come to my mouth or all the cups come in? According to Dharmakriti, that cup, the concept of the cup is empty. So we need to focus on the object directly, and it needs to be in one time and place and needs to create an effect to be real. Okay? That's a logical way of looking at things, guys. Okay? According to the Western mind, we call those things universals, things that apply in general. When I say a certain thing, a bus, you're not going to look at, you kind of an idea, the thing with the four wheels that takes a lot of people. But I bet you some people will think of a school bus, another of a Greyhound, another one of a different bus. We all have our concept of a bus. It exists in your mind, but it's not an objective reality right now. It's just words. Does it make sense? Okay, so since we're gonna, that's why I'm doing it in such a way that we can try to fathom some of these things, okay? So, although the universal cup is everywhere, Dharmakriti would say, it's just a creation of my thought. It does not exist. That's how they look at it, logically. Okay, let's take a look at Harry Potter. It's a really good one. Everybody knows Harry Potter? The story, movies, Harry Potter? So, Harry Potter is a creation, a name, has a function. You can even know he's in Midland, England. He's somewhere, he lives at a certain place. He probably has a very good life. But it's a figment of an imagination by an author who wrote a book and gave Harry Potter a life. But in your mind, when you think of Harry Potter, there it is. So does Harry Potter exist? No. It's just a fabricated, just like everything else is. Our mind consistently makes a word for language purposes. It looks at it as it really exists. And then we look at everything as a whole. So we take it a little further. I'll read this. This is a little statement that will put perspective on this. So the word by word, for something to be true, for something to be real, according to Dharmakriti, its essence must be objectively established and not artificially ascribed by words and thoughts. Also, the essence must include the ability to perform a function and to be unique in time and space. That's objective. Emily, I can give you this in writing later on. Don't just listen, allow your mind to just open it up. we will have these conversations. This is, doesn't go very, like, I read it many times, you know, to really, really be able to say something about it. So very easy for something to be true, for something to be real. According to Dharmakriti, its essence must be objectively established, not artificially ascribed like Harry Potter, or by words and thoughts. But if you look at everything, it is all words and thoughts. Everything. This wall, your name, you, me, color, cushion, they're words. Then we have to now say, well, the cushion is there. So we have to objectively look at it, say, is there a cushion there? Or is it just a name and a thought that we provided, something that looks like that, a cushion? So are you looking at the cloth? Are you looking at the sponge underneath it? Are you looking at the thread? Are you looking at the color? Where is the cushion? So then...
Maska, it's kind of in line, but... How do you prove the existence of the subtle level of consciousness? I get the point that there is no I, but if you get down to a subtle level of consciousness, how do you prove that? You've got aggregates together, you put the label on it, you strip away the I, the Kevin, but how do you prove that that subtle level of consciousness does exist?
Well, there is an example they give you. Form and appearances and these forces come into play. They give you an example of rainbow, which I'll go through in a minute. So think of it this way. Look at a foam in a running water. The foam takes place. It's got movement. It's got things happening. But so many things are working to make that foam appear at that point. The river is flowing. So many things. It's been splashing. Think of the creation. It's been impermanent. Many aspects of things are moving along. But they do say that there is subtle energy there because it is appearing. It is being perceived, and it disappears again. It comes to the beach and again becomes the foam. So in that way, look at the rainbow. Is rainbow there? You see it, but then you can say it is a specific reaction of moisture and light. But then neither the moisture is a rainbow, neither the light is a rainbow, but the rainbow appears. We appear like that, and that the subtle energy that makes this happen, it is probably so minute, it is how phenomena works, that it, because of causes and conditions, a rainbow appears, and we give it a name, and as soon as you give it a name, we think it's real. So we'll talk about that. We'll dissect that. It just takes a little time to get to the point. Otherwise, it throws people off, right? So I'm going to talk about that. So let's go back to that cup again and occupying space. So this is gets interesting now, okay? So when we look at this cup, what is occupying the space is that cup. It is unitary. And if this was a coffee cup with a ceramic, so let's take a look. Think about a cup in front of you. That's a beautiful ceramic cup, right? So it's unitary, single, homogeneous. You can all agree to that. It occupies that space and time, location. Okay? Or is it discrete particles occupying individual space? Think about that. You look at that cup. It's made up of what? Clay. Clay is made up of small particles. Right? Particles are made up of smaller particles, maybe in atoms and all the way, or whatever. So then are you looking at the particles existing or a cup existing? Okay. Very pragmatic way of looking at things. It's getting to the same point, but in a nice way. The cup is ceramic. It's made out of clay. Clay is a compound of particles. What is real here, the cup or the clay particles? You might say both. Right? Our mind will go immediately, yeah, it's just both, as the cup is collective appearance of the particles that make it up. That's where our mind goes to that level. So each particle makes an appearance collectively. They make the appearance we associate with the term cup. Right? Individual particles come together. We label it a cup. And we call it a cup, right? It's the association of the total whole. So here it gets interesting. So let's look at closer to that mistaken conception, of how the misconception is apprehending a single thing in place where there is multitude of particles. Okay. If I were to just boil this down in a shorter time frame, we can even look at another thing. We look at the cup as a static cup, permanent. We don't even think that the cup, minute particles are changing every moment. Correct? We don't even think it's actually something is going on. Everything is static, it's there, it's whole, it's a cup. Okay? So we need to understand that whole process in our mind, how things we perceive. In the end, cup is a structured language we use to talk, but there is no cup. You just have to need to know that your mind, just because our parents started, we went to school, and our teachers and our parents, and we have to communicate with each other, so we created this mind. All they are trying to say is that picture of a cup is a thought. We think about a cup, we kind of assume what that cup is like, or we look at it and call it a cup. And that's okay. Conventionally, we have to live. If I were to tell Jack, let's go have a cup of coffee, he's not going to bring me a bucket. So we have to conventionally discuss and talk, but we need to understand how we perceive things. It's important to know that our mind sees a cup, and we think it's a cup. Everywhere it's a cup. But it's a thought only. If you were to really look at it, it's particles, it has clay in it, it has created a shape out of it, it is changing every moment. So again, we are just looking at an object right now, but when we look at our human nature and the eye, that's where how we need to dig into to understand who am I? What are these? What's living in me? Like he would say, what's moving on? What is this? We collectively, we put this frame around us, we identify strongly with a strong feeling of I, right? And then this whole purpose here is to identify those things. And because of time, I'm going to move a little quickly. We'll come back to this again in my summaries. That's why every class, I go through this repeatedly, because it will settle in more and more and more slowly. But now it goes into further, and this Dharmakriti even says that we see things that way because this is how our mind conceives it. True? It's all in our mind. We make it, so we create a thought, that's how it is. But Chandrakriti, the one that we follow under Nagarjuna saying, hold it. You can't put this entire thing on your mind. Because mind itself is an element of change. Think of that for a second. They're saying you just can't just throw that on your mind. Then what is mind? That mind is to a composite of, it's a composite of mental continuum. So then, I tell you in the beginning, it automatically takes you to the point where things are nihilistic, nothing exists. If my mind is also a composite of continuum, and externally things are empty of existing, then everything, nothing exists. Remember, guys, one thing. Two realities. Conventionally, we see forms. I see Anna. I see Adriana. Your form is there. We perceive it. What we are trying to find out, we are not denying the fact that you have a form and there's a form and I see it. You are trying to find out how you exist. So you've got to keep that separate in your mind. Don't take one concept of ultimate truth to think nothing exists. And this is where a lot of people get very confused. You need to contemplate it that way. Forms do appear. They appear because of causes and condition. But when you look at each thing on its own as if it intrinsically exists, it does not. That's all this is all about. The tree, you see a beautiful tree. I've been talking about that tree. You see a tree. But when you look at it very carefully, you have a label called tree. You even sublevel it, that's an oak, that's an hickory. You have all these things because of what it does, what it looks like. We create those labels, we create a picture. All hickories must look the same. All oaks must look the same. But when you really look at the tree, you look at the components of it, you look at how interdependent that tree is with other things, water, earth, bugs, name it, is all interconnected and dependent arising, right? We all are that way. And a lot of these things that we create is because we create out of language and in our mind through thoughts.
Could we talk about a jumping eye?
Jumping eye.
I was thinking, no? If we could talk about a jumping eye. Let's see the flame. The flame at one point and the other is different. So the eye is jumping.
So
the previous moment to the next one. But you still have an eye. I say the jumping eye, no? Let's see, you jump from this life to the next one. What is the thing that is remain that you could identify as yourself, no? Because see, when we die, we bring the experience that we have, let's see, in the previous moment, and this is the thing that we carry on.
Right. So I'll tell you in short, before we go to the meditation on that, to just satisfy your mind, there is a very subtle energy. Okay, we can go to that subtle energy. Goes on. Okay? And the causes and conditions that you have created by your activity is like a seed, goes with that subtle energy. And then you have to define what that energy is. So that's what we'll get to that. And we need to go through certain things for the class so that we can, I told you I will get to your point because everybody wants to know if this is what happens when you think nihilistically, if nothing exists, then what is it that moves on? Where are we going? How is the next life form? And you can go into cycle of the 12 links, how the birth takes place, how we, all that is fine, but you're looking for that. Right? So I can just tell you that there is the subtle energy. That's all it is right now. The phenomena is such. It is changing. It is impermanent. It is moving. Many, many, beyond our concept, things are happening. You think around you right now, how much oxygen, how much nitrogen, what your cells are doing, what your mitochondria is doing, how genetically your predisposition, how many hairs are for. It just has so many activities going on in the change. There is something going on. That subtle energy that brings all about around you moves on. Okay, so we can talk about that. So all we can say is just like that rainbow example I gave you, just think about it, appearance do happen. All we are trying to find out, is that rainbow real? Then you find out, wait a minute, I see the color, the violet, indigo, blue, green, yellow, red, I can see that. But there's no rainbow. We named it a rainbow because it's appearance, right? It comes from moisture. Moisture is not a rainbow. It comes from its own other dependencies. That whole phenomena is like that. Appearances come and cycle goes on. It just does these things. Okay. 8:20. Okay. We can go on and on. I have so many examples. Look at the boundaries we create between countries. The birds don't know anything about boundaries, do they? Do they think I'm flying to Mexico or Canada today? Or I'm going to Argentina? They apparently didn't get it. We do it on a map. If boundaries or borders were real, then the earth, the water, the fire, everything in there has to be concretely a border. Otherwise, there's no border. We just created it in our mind, on a map, on a Google map maybe. Okay? So anyways, in the end, what it comes down to, we have to develop qualities and develop a lifestyle to be able and be at least have the capability, use these faculties that we have on a spiritual path, this understanding of how things are, very important. Okay? So there's a meditation on I, or I can do a four-point analysis meditation. 10 minutes, maybe we can do the four-point analysis. It because we haven't covered the points in detail, you may lose, but I will pick it up. Or let's do maybe it's better to do meditation on I. And then next class, when we do come back, we'll do a meditation on four-point analysis. Fair? Because I don't want to get more complex. Right now, guys, we have 10 minutes, so we'll go through this, no problem. Just remember, phenomena, how it is, how things are in phenomena. Just remember simple things. Everything is interdependent, right? There's dependent arising, and due to causes and conditions, we move from life to life. Okay, there's something that moves, and what is that? And if you look at it intrinsically, does it truly exist on its own, or does some other functions are working to do that? It's just the way things, you look at the ocean, look at how things, how the leaves form, all because of dependent arising. Okay? But because we are human, we want to know what is that me that wants to move to the next life. We can talk that when we do four-point analysis. So today we're going to do a meditation. So let's do a meditation. So meditate like this. I am sitting here. So close your eyes, relax, open your mind. So meditate, I am sitting here. Each of us can think, I am sitting here. I do not seem to be a construct like Harry Potter. I am not fictional. I exist. I am real. I perform functions. Harry Potter performs functions too, but only because the author said so, not because he actually did so. I perform functions, speak, move around, cast a shadow, all these things I do by myself. I am real. So then question, which body is sitting there? Whose body is sitting here? Are you thinking about your body or someone else's body? Well, usually when a person thinks I am sitting here, they're referring to their own body. So then think, does your body really belong to you? Why not? There are no slaves around here. It's your body. Well then, is it your body that's doing the sitting, or are you doing the sitting? Or are you both identical? The body is certainly sitting. You are certainly sitting. Are there two sittings that are taking place, or one sitting taking place? There is only one sitting when you think I am sitting here. And even though the body is also sitting, it doesn't mean that there are two sittings. There's only one sitting. So, are you identical to your body? The meaning of identical is to be not different in any ways. Or are you just your body? Do the expressions I have a body and the body has a body have exactly the same meaning for you? They do not, because you think of yourself differently from the way you think of your body. And yet, there is still only one sitting taking place, not two. If the I was a real object, then it would be either identical with the body, or this would have to be two sittings going on. Perhaps there is a third possibility, namely that the body is not sitting. Think of it. I am sitting, but my body is not sitting. Then you are really independent from your body. If that's the case, why do you bother sitting? The only way you can have one sitting and two things doing, it is if one or both of those things are creations of thoughts. You can just create that in your mind. It is simple. I have the thought, I am sitting here, while the body is sitting. That's how it works. But is it that how we feel when we think I am sitting here? Doesn't it feel a bit more than that? Don't we feel more concrete than an imaginary person invented by words in relation to the body posture? Don't we feel a little bit different from that? well, I am not the sound. I am not even the thought I. The thought I does not have to sit after all. But then the sitting posture of the body and the thought I am sitting appear mixed or associated. We have this indisputable activity being done by a person called me. When analyzed, if you take the sound I by itself, that's not me, nor is the thought of I me. The body is not me either. Put all of these components aside, and there is no me. There is no I whatsoever. Look right there where you feel yourself the most, right here, maybe the chest, where you can point to yourself and proclaim yourself loudly, here I am, sitting in this place right now. How quickly this fantasy is dismissed, like a bubble popping, when you consider how different the part of your chest covered by your pointing finger or the hand in front from who or not what you think you are. Let me repeat that. How quickly this fantasy is dismissed, like a bubble popping, when you consider how different the part of your chest covered by your pointing finger or hand is from who or what you think you are. Something it feels hard as a stone right in the center of the chest, such as when someone calls us stupid. That sensation, however, does not require a solid object to be felt. If we believe in something strongly enough, our nervous system will accommodate that belief by functioning as if it were true. Our muscles will constrict as if grabbing hold of an object tightly. Even a mime exhibits all physical strain as if imaginary boulder he is carrying was real. Likewise, the muscle in our chest constrict around an imaginary self we believe to be real. We have an unfortunate habit of believing indiscriminately that objects exist as they appear. However, our mind is capable of generating appearances without any objective fact. People believe in existence of unicorns, dragons, other fantastic creatures, only because they are described with words and drawings in books. Although we can imagine such things, it doesn't mean that they are real. An object may appear as if its presence was made known by a sheer force of it appearing to us, like a reflection appears in a mirror, through the force of an object placed in front of it. However, an object may appear, though subjective rather than objective, it may be creation of words and thought. We may, out of habit, believe that objects exist in their own rights, because this is how they appear to us. But when analyzed, we discover that they never existed that way. Not even an atom was ever really there. You can believe in a real self, and you can even give it a name. You can claim it is the agent of all sorts of activity and provide it with a history, but it was never ever there. The Buddha said, the person, ourself, never truly existed, not even a part of it. Never ever was it really there as a concrete entity. As a creation of thought and speech, it has nominal existence established by conventions according to arbitrary but accepted rules of language. As such, it is there. It has all kinds of qualities. It even performs functions that are conceptually attributed to it. But that self, that me, never appeared to you or anyone else through the force of its own existence. Last, when we appear, that appearance does not arise in the mirror of our mind through the force of the person in front of it. It appears by the means of words and thought like a fictional character, just like Harry Potter. Our mind is a magician that makes fantasy appear as reality. It's an illusion. Thank you. I'll do a quick dedication. By pacifying distractions to wrong objects and correctly analyzing the meaning of reality, please bless me to generate quickly within my mind stream the unified path of calm abiding and special insight. This is according to Lama Zopa Rinpoche. Lama Tsongkhapa. Due to these merits, may I quickly attain Buddhahood and lead all living beings without exception into the enlightened state. Like Lama Tsongkhapa, may I able to offer extensive benefits equaling the limitless sky to all sentient beings and teachings of Buddha. From now on in all future lives, may all living beings abide in equanimity, free of bias, attachment, and anger. May all living beings have happiness and its causes. May all living beings be free of suffering and its causes. May all living beings not be separated from sorrowless bliss. I will bring this about myself alone. Thank you.